In today's Overshare show, I interviewed author Andrew Lose, who wrote the book Confessions of an Ivy League Frat Boy. The book centers on his experience at Dartmouth College and basically deconstructs his relationship and his analysis and thinking about hazing and the culture that exists around that type of groupthink or mentality that happens when you're in a frat, and hazing is a huge part of the social dynamic. I don't know about you guys, but I was not part of the Greek culture in my college experience. I actually chose a school that didn't have that as part of the social fabric because I was really concerned about having to be in a sorority in order to have a functional social life at college. If you're not part of the Greek life, you're not part of the scene, or you're not part of the party, or you're not part of the fun. I think I probably partied way too much in high school to think that partying at that extent in college was good for me. My liver was like, man, why did you do this to me? You're only 17. So I think that like maybe I got a lot out of my system at a young age. But I think that happens when you grow up in a city. You have more access and more exposure for homeless people to buy you 40 ounces of beer. So I didn't crave that, but I do know that a lot of people, when they're thinking about school and they're thinking about college, the academic side of it or the intellectual side of it isn't exactly their priority. What they're more interested in is the experience, the social experience of it. And I do think that especially today's youth feel that college is almost their God-given right, or at least some sort of rite of passage for them to participate in. And when they envision college, it has a lot to do with partying, having sex with strangers, and drinking excessive amounts of alcohol. And I do think that that has a huge impact on society and culture, because you go into crazy debt when you go to college. And if you spend that time just figuring out how to get finger banged or how to finger bang with precision, you're probably going to be like, whoa, where did that $200,000 go? I found Andrew's book and the many articles that he's written about this subject to be really interesting, specifically because he's looking at the philosophical conundrum of hazing and groupthink. I mean, I think that's really what it's about. When you participate in activities that you would never do otherwise, or you treat people in ways that if you had your wits about you or you were alone in a room, you would probably never be like, hey, dude, why don't you puke on my dick? But within the context of hazing, that makes sense. And when I think about the men who are a part of fraternity culture and these becoming the men who are basically ruling our world, especially Ivy League frat boys, let's be honest here. Harvard graduates, Yale graduates, Dartmouth graduates, these are the guys that are part of Wall Street. They're making decisions every day that have huge impact on public policy, on politics, on the way that the governance of the world operates. These guys spend an ample amount of time in a semi-rapey culture, devouring each other, devouring alcohol, and thinking that the world owed it to them. There's an entitlement to fraternity culture, especially in the Ivy League world, that frightens me. And I do think that that has permeated our global stratosphere, because American men have a huge impact on how the world operates financially and politically. So I think that this is more than just a conversation about fraternities and whether or not it's cool to be in a kiddie pool of diarrhea and sperm. It's much deeper than that. It's about a culture of men that have major influence on the world and how they are indoctrinating themselves during a very pivotal time of them understanding their masculinity and their own manhood. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I really did. Andrew's a really smart guy, and I commend him for speaking out about this issue, because it wasn't easy to go against a culture you were a part of. Anytime you're a whistleblower of sorts, it has to really impact your identity and sense of self. So thanks, Andrew, for talking to me and for writing this book and for bringing this conversation to light. So So you always wanted to go to Dartmouth, but how did the reality compare to the fantasy in your head?
Well, I don't know if it was a fantasy just in my head. I think it was a fantasy in a lot of people's heads. And it's a fantasy that the school trades on as an institution, as a brand. And it's tied into all these weird traditions or weird kind of narratives about how the place came to be, when in reality, some of the school was built on this, Christianizing the Native Americans. Some of the first people there were slaves. I mean, you know, it was built on alcohol too. Eliezer Wheelock, you know, the mythical founder of Dartmouth College, you know, as the song goes, educated the Indians with 500 gallons of New England rum. So there's this weird kind of tradition of drinking and inculcating a certain kind of culture that goes back to the late 18th century, you know, when the school was founded.
Were you aware of that before you went to school? Or when you were in high school applying to colleges, was it more like, hey, I just want to have a good time and this is an Ivy League school that has a certain cachet?
I mean, I knew some of it. You know, my grandfather had gone there. My older brother was there when I applied. You know, not that I grew up hearing about it from my grandfather, but I kind of grew up in the presence of it. You know, he was a person who seemed to be really entwined, like his successes were entwined with the experiences that he had there. And he was a person that I idolized. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. I didn't want to go into it too much. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's also kind of funny too. And I was more conservative, you know, before I went to college, like actually conservative. So I guess I would be lying if I said that some of that didn't appeal to me in a sense. There was a kind of traditionalism. You know, when the school's unofficial motto is "less the old traditions fail." You know, and that can be easily changed if you remove one letter to just "let the old traditions fail," which is kind of like where I find myself now and where a lot of people, you know, find themselves, like vis-a-vis the culture.
Well, let's talk a little bit about these traditions. So obviously in your book and in these articles that you've been a part of, especially the one for the Rolling Stone, you're kind of outing frat culture. So when you got to school, you knew that being in a fraternity was going to be part of your identity. It was going to lead you into the adult life you were planning on living. So bring us back to that state of mind you were in, being a freshman and wanting to do anything to be involved in these types of groups.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just me, too. I mean, there's a real social pressure there. I mean, and it's interesting, too, in the last couple of years with all these controversies, the percentage of students who are involved in those groups who pledge a fraternity or sorority has increased. And SAE, the fraternity that I had been in, has their recruitment has increased, too, in spite of all these things. So it was just something, and I know I mentioned this in the book, but there was a phrase that people used that joining a frat would, you know, you weren't a real person until you pledged. So, you know, but I mean, I think it's cheap to just blame it on the peer pressure. Like, obviously, it's something that people willingly undertake, but there's such a connection, like a really deeper connection, where that culture, which is a subset, kind of like a bastardization of the school's culture in general, kind of trades on this connection, this identity connection between the frats as like the heart of the school traditionally, and that if you want to be kind of close to that beating heart of the Dartmouth tradition, which many people find appealing, and I found appealing, you know, you would have to kind of enter through this initiation process. And also, I don't want to gloss over the fact, too, that that for like 18 to 22 year old boys who haven't really had any kind of real experiences, a lot of these people are like upper middle class or like wealthier kids. They like this is like that hazing experience might be like the most real thing they'd ever experienced, like the only time where they could really be like bad. And I think that there was something intoxicating about that to I mean, I'll speak for myself, but also for a lot of us. I mean, I think that was. There was something appealing about that. But I think that it's funny because nobody quite realized like what was going to happen. And during the hazing, the pledge process, you're kind of kept in secret, you know, about it, or it's kept in secret from you. Whereas if you were kind of looking at these different frats in the same way that you were maybe looking at applying to colleges and seeing like the strengths and weaknesses, the different kind of proclivities, identities of them, if there was some kind of thing up front where they said, okay, this is the laundry list of all the awful and kind of grim things you're going to have to do, I would find it highly unlikely that any of us would have joined. You know, like there were whispers, there were rumors of what went on. You know, and I had heard a little bit from my older brother, but he was in the one frat that didn't haze. I mean, they still hazed, but it's not like the hazing that I talk about in my book. You know, it was like technically optional, whereas like the hazing that we experienced was really not optional. Yeah, where were we?
Well, I mean, you were kind of talking about initiation, and you have these 18 to, you know, 20-year-old boys who are becoming initiated into a group.
Yeah.
And, you know, something that I think about is like in a lot of cultures across the world, they have really major initiations for young men and young women, whether it's circumcision or like being eaten by fire ants, or there's all sorts of extreme acts that young people go through to initiate themselves into adulthood. But in those contexts, even though there is a societal peer pressure that exists, there also seems to be like a spiritual element or something that gives it a morality. And when I look at the hazing that you experienced, that you wrote about, it seemed so unnecessarily brutal. And then the conjunction with the alcohol and the excessive drinking, I mean, that takes away from any spiritual transcendence.
Yeah. But I mean, it's funny that you would mention that too, because I do see it as having a spiritual significance for a lot of people, like I said, who might not have otherwise had any kind of philosophical or religious deeper connection to anything. And that at that point in their lives, and maybe for a lot of them after that, that was like as deep as they went into like themselves and into kind of being kind of destroyed and rebuilt. And that was definitely part of it. I mean, people have drawn the parallel to, you know, like a military boot camp, but I think that your parallel is a little bit better. And that's something that I wish that more people would have picked up on. That it does have a spiritual dimension. And that's also why it's so difficult for people to say anything about it.
Right.
You know, to criticize it in any way. And as time goes by, they become like more and more nostalgic about it, because it was this point in time. I mean, it's such a crucial point in a boy's life, like a young man's life, to have that experience where like all limits are erased and where you're brought into what you're told is this age-old secret, you know. But the secret is that there's really no secret. I talk about that in the book. I mean, it's all kind of the psychological pyramid scheme that gets you to buy in, and in some ways a financial pyramid scheme too. And there's no big revelation. You know, it's all kind of just like a really dark joke. It's a very mean joke. But instead of accepting that it's just an utterly meaningless nihilistic joke, people have to reflect some kind of meaning into it, you know, defend it for the rest of their lives in some cases.
Well, yeah, and there is, I think, a profundity to having a life experience where you push through a boundary where you think, oh my God, I'm going to die if I drink 6 beers in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you don't die. It's kind of akin to what a woman would experience with childbirth when she's like, holy fuck, I'm going to die. This is so painful. But she pushes through it. These acts that these young men take part in that are really pushing their boundaries. I mean, some of the things you wrote about were so effing gross.
Yeah.
You know, like the vomit omelets where you like eat each other's puke and you like puke on each other consistently. I mean, that was something I thought a lot about, was this cultural bulimia and how like there was like so much
that's
like
really,
intake.
That's really astute, yeah.
Right? Like you're just like intaking all of this stuff and then vomiting it out and not appreciating it. What you were talking about, where there is like this connection to whatever you experience in college and how you justify it in the outside world. And when you have the politics and the businessmen and the bankers who are also right now experiencing their own cultural bulimia of how they treat resources.
Yeah, you know, I would want to get to that in a minute, but first, I think, too, that it's a sad reflection on just American society or just modern society in general, because we don't have enough other mechanisms where people feel as if they're brought into a community or initiated into a sense of knowledge, and that when you have these like highly capable, highly intelligent, and for the most part, like really good people, I mean, they're not, as individuals, I don't think there's, for the most part, nothing wrong with them, but it's kind of like an indictment of the culture at large or the historical moment that we're in, that this is still a part of it. Or that I wonder, too, if there's a disconnect that maybe at one point in time when our society was structured in a different way, these systems had more meaning. They were capable of creating more meaning or creating more social cohesion. But that's from a world where women didn't go to college, women couldn't vote. In some cases, I mean, SAE was founded before the Civil War in the South, where, you know, people you know, owned slaves. So it's kind of delusional for people to think that those types of social organizations would fit into the world that we live in now in the 21st century, in the same way that it would be kind of delusional on a less violent level to believe that a medieval guild could take root in Silicon Valley and that that would somehow be like a really useful, productive, you know, thing to do. So I think that there's also... There's a disconnect, and I don't think it begins and ends with the fraternities. I think it starts earlier with how we educate boys and how we treat boys in our society, that allows that the fraternity culture and a lot of ways that mirrors sports teams and universities and colleges, it's an indictment that those things that we still think that there are still people who defend that as having some sort of value, and I think that what we were kind of about to talk about next was what kind of people, do these institutions create, you know, and how can we be critical, not in like a negative way, but critical in trying to understand, you know, that. And I think that when you get down to it on a basic level, you know, it produces people who can justify the abuse of other people based on a patriarchal hierarchy, and it creates people who are very good at lying and who are very good at working within these institutions, which don't put people's needs first. I mean, the fraternity is not an institution about people's needs. It's an institution about the fraternity's needs. And in the same way that the college, the Dartmouth College, appears to be less and less an institution about the students' needs and the people's needs and their health and their lives, and educating the whole student, than it is about, you know, the school itself. And I think I don't think that that's unique among colleges. I mean, I think too that when we talk about fraternities and when we talk about rape on campus and when we talk about the sexism and the, you know, racism and whatnot, that's all a part of that, we're also making an indictment of how our university system in general is structured and who benefits from it. I think that a lot of the reluctance at Dartmouth and at other schools to do away with those cultures is financial, that it produces people who work fit very well into the financial edifice that we have and our society is structured around now, and then they kick back a lot of money in the future. I mean, for example, there were three other frats in the past 10 or 15 years at Dartmouth who have committed some pretty heinous things that, while not necessarily hazing, you know, earned them derecognition from the college. There was one frat that tried to burn down the frat next door. They were derecognized. There was one frat that published a patented date rape guide. They were derecognized. There was one frat that had secret cameras installed so that they could film women having sex with the brothers without their knowledge or consent, obviously. And the thing that those three fraternities have in common is that they were all, after they were derecognized for clearly violating criminal and, you know, college guidelines, all came back. They were all let back in by the college. And many people believe that there was money that changed hands. I mean, you know, I have heard that, in that situation. So, you know, And it really goes to the highest level. I mean, there was an investigation by the New Hampshire Attorney General about a year and a half, 2 years ago, of the Dartmouth College trustees. In terms of most of them were these large Wall Street finance, private equity titans, and they would invest the college's endowment, multi-billion-dollar fund, into their private equity funds. They would receive large management fees, in some cases like $30 million. And they were the owners of these funds, these financial funds. And then the college's endowment would, you know, either be diminished or not really improve at a rate. You know, there was no advantage to doing so. And it's become, many people believe, a kind of pay-to-play environment where as long as those people at the top could keep that financial edifice running in a way that they find to be gainful for themselves, what happens to the little people on the bottom doesn't matter, you know?
Right, and I mean...
I feel like I'm saying way too much here.
No. I love what you're saying. But I think that's talking about brotherhood and secrecy. When you have a really tight brotherhood that will keep secrets for each other, that's what keeps corruption possible in the police, in the political system, in Wall Street, with bankers. And I do think there's something about viewing yourself as an inclusive group and excluding others. And you were talking before about the male identity and these young boys like trying to find themselves as men and figuring out their masculinity within a world where masculine identity is about dominance. Yeah. And, you know, I was like reading all hazing descriptions and there is this like, I'm going to psychologically and physically dominate you type of mentality. And I wonder, you know, when you talk about rape culture and obviously there is this connection between the two, is dominance part of the prevailing ethos behind rape? I mean, I'm not a man. I've never raped anyone. So
no,
I don't know. And if you're not a raper...
No.
We're both clueless on the whole raping thing.
Well,
but what is it that you witness? Like, how did dominance, both of each other as men and of women, play a part in this theme?
I think there's a huge connection. And this is something I talked about in my piece in Cosmo that came out last month. That there is inevitably a connection between the broken male socialization dynamic at Dartmouth and at other colleges like it, and the broken male-female dynamic that, you know, is evidenced in this huge rape problem where 1 in 4, you know, college women are sexually assaulted. 95% of these cases are not reported because there's not the resources and the support for it. And then the ones that are, you know, are not really adequately adjudicated, whether on the college level or on the police level. I mean, there was a rape case at Dartmouth in the last year where there was a young man who, I mean, the facts of the case were not in doubt. He entered, barely acquaintances, the guy and the girl, entered her room, raped her while she was sleeping. She went to the police. I mean, there was, I think, 6 or 7 felony counts against this guy, but he was from an incredibly wealthy family who had been, you know, a family that had founded one of these large financial corporations, banks, I guess. And, you know, they had, you know, the Grafton County prosecutor, some would say, didn't have, by any stretch, the resources to compete with, you know, this very wealthy family who, you know, hired 6-figure lawyers and, you know, relocated them to New Hampshire just to get the kid acquitted. And he was acquitted. And he never took the stand. You know, the girl took the stand. She was, you know, cross-examined to death. The family of the perpetrator sent a private investigator to her hometown. I mean, it was like, you know, victim blaming at the highest level. So I think that all of those aspects are connected. But to get back to the fraternity point, I think that space plays a role in this exercise of power. So when you join the fraternity as a pledge, there becomes this gray area of consent. Like, are you really consenting to being humiliated in this way? You don't know what's going to be happening to you. You're kept in the dark as each thing progresses. You know, you're forced, coerced, told, commanded, whatever, however you want to look at it, to drink obscene amounts of alcohol, or that you would face punishment, or that your pledge brothers would face punishment if you don't carry your part of that load. And then once you're so heavily intoxicated, then there's a lot of nudity, aspects of kind of quasi-sexual, homoerotic domination and submission. And I think that as a pledge, you come to associate that this is a place where this type of power is exercised, and that's how it works. And that, you know, and when you're not a brother, you don't have the privilege of having any power in that space. You know, you're in a subordinate position. And then I feel as though it becomes internalized, that then when you become a brother, you are given that privilege to exercise that power, and that power can be exercised subconsciously, unconsciously, on anyone who enters the space, who is not a brother. And I think that that's why all the research, and there are tons of books written about just, you know, the fraternity sexual assault problem. There's one called Fraternity Gang Rape by Peggy Sande, who's a UPenn anthropologist, who traces a clear connection to the rape culture on campus with fraternities. And I think that it goes directly into how the group is kind of inculcated, and how power is exercised, and how the understanding of power is internalized. And then you see that it becomes connected to this space where you can exercise the power, and where their consent is a gray area, and where you are dominant and all others are submissive.
There is definitely a high that comes from that, from kind of lording over someone and controlling them. And I think the danger that happens is for young girls who are invited to frat parties, it's part of being cool for them too. You know, so they get seduced into the culture just as much as the boys do, yet the consequence for the girls who are assaulted or even who allow themselves to be violated. I mean, I'm sure there's a huge number of girls who do things they regret. They may never have said no, but they never said yes either. I do think there's like this interesting duality between a fraternity that's like, we are the power, and the girls that are seduced and attracted to that power that is taken out in the world in general. We talk about a patriarchy, and what does a patriarchy really mean? It's not just about like maternity leave or how much someone gets paid over another. A patriarchy is about the fact that men hold a psychological power in culture that women are attracted to. We participate in this like weird twisted way of facilitating this kind of power over us, which is like, I think, really complex for women and men. And because like for the guy, they also know like, hey, I'm getting girls because I'm part of this fraternity and I'm now attractive and like chicks are into me, even though maybe it has a totally rapey vibe.
Yeah, well, I think too that it's about a social construction of power. It's not, you know, a lot of people have said that, you know, these criticisms of the system are false or not worthy because it's this kind of bad apple theory. That, oh, it's only a couple bad people, but in general, the system is sound. And as long as we, you know, deal with these individuals who are demented, you know, that somehow it will be different. But it's clearly not that way. I mean, nobody exists in a vacuum, and least of all at that age and in this type of culture. I mean, and the types of, you know, hazing and events I talk about in the book are never things that any of us would have individually undertaken, you know, outside of that context. We would have never individually, like, agreed to it, or any of those people who had hazed me or hazed our group of pledges, if I met them on the street somewhere, I would have never thought, oh, okay, this is a person who is going to vomit on me or who's going to, you know, going to give me a cup of vinegar or a cup of urine to chug. So these things exist in the context of that space. And when you have that, we're talking about 18 to 22-year-old boys being given a mansion and being given, like, a shit ton of money with really no oversight to do really whatever they want. I mean, and I don't know why people would be so confused that the result of that would be unhealthy, negative, and violent. I mean, especially these are, you know, people who have never had any, like I was saying before, lack a kind of real-world experience of, you know, any kind of direct experience of themselves or of society. Like, this is they're going directly from their, their suburban, you know, in most cases, suburban, upper middle class, you know, families, you know, into this. And I think that there's a, you know, I was on a panel one time where one person had mentioned, well, what if we had a mandatory year of national service like they have in other countries, you know, like in Singapore, you know, or Israel. A little bit different, but you know, I wonder if maybe that would do it. I mean, a lot of times I've wondered, has this problem gotten worse over time? Is there something unique about this time and about this generation and about society as it's developed now, or has it always been this way and we just haven't known about it because nobody has talked about it? Or, you know, and it's one of these things that's impossible to pull apart. Like, I can't imagine my grandfather at Dartmouth doing these things that. You know, we had done.
Especially because I'm picturing him as a grandpa swimming in a poopy, semen-filled bathtub. I'm like, that makes no sense.
Yeah, I couldn't see it.
But at the same time, I do think there is a definite influence of media on how
exactly,
like, young people relate to college. So, you know, you have this kind of like Animal House movies, or you have like the American Pie series or what have
Van
you.
Wilder.
Yeah, there are a lot of movies that are like, hey, guess what? College
Greek,
is about
the TV show.
Yes. College is about partying. It's about sex. It's about having fun.
I think too, okay, like if we're talking in the most macroscopic sense, I think that is one of these mechanisms that system uses to financially perpetuate itself. Because when college becomes an experience that is kind of unquantifiable, you know, but everybody has to have that experience. And if they don't have that experience, they're not really allowed to participate in the society as we've constructed it. You know, you have to lay that money down, or your family has to lay that money down. You have to take out these loans. You know, it's kind of like if you look at it in a very general sense, it's this weird kind of indentured servitude that's sold to you through this experiential lens, through the sexual lens, through the lens of substances that you would have access to in this environment. It's the best 4 years of your life. You know, I mean, this is all marketing. You know, it's not about the love of enlightenment or knowledge or some kind of philosophical introspection. And maybe it was never like that, but I think it was at one point in time.
I think there was definitely a more intellectual reputation in the past because it was such a privilege to go to college. And now because of the college loan system, basically anyone can go. And you're right. Like if Dartmouth, if Dartmouth fraternities was like, hey, come join our frat and read Kierkegaard and have a poetry slam.
That would be
like,
awesome.
Yeah, it would be. But you wouldn't have that same cachet as what's happening now culturally, where you're like, come to college, get wasted, fuck all you want, and you're never gonna live this hedonistic life again, so appreciate it.
But the funny thing is too that a lot of these people still continue that type of lifestyle afterwards. The people who make enough money to be insulated enough to do that,
right?
And I think that the behaviors that you learn at that age, if you don't disabuse yourself of them and disabuse yourself of the ideas that are then entangled in them, then I mean, it's a system that produces like really sad alcoholic people, and a lot of people who have a broken understanding of how men and women, relate in society.
Right. And the alcoholism within the culture is almost like this constant out of body experience. Like you drink to a point where you're not dealing with reality, and that helps you make decisions that you wouldn't necessarily make if you were in your right frame
of mind.
And I
think it also fills the void of a kind of lack of deeper reality in American culture in general, that other experiences that would take you out of your body or give you access to a sort of spiritual knowledge that you might not otherwise have are criminalized, are totally impugned in the media. That
right.
This is the only acceptable way to do that is to drink a lot of alcohol.
Right. It's not like do some acid and reflect on fractals.
Yeah. No, that's not really a part of it.
One thing that I was kind of curious about in terms of your own story is like here you were immersed in this culture and then you made a decision to kind of turn your back on it. So can you tell a little bit about how that happened?
Well, I mean, it's really complicated. And I would be lying if I said that I could totally explain it to you now. There are so many factors involved in it. There are motives on different levels. I think the first thing is that I probably would have never been a person that would have gotten involved in it to begin with it anywhere other than Dartmouth. There was something different about Dartmouth for me just on a personal level. That's not an understanding that I can easily translate to someone else, because Dartmouth is in a lot of ways like a cult.
Right.
It's a cult that we all can take part in, and that you get benefits for doing it, and you pay a price to become a member. You're sort of initiated into it. It's so hard for me to explain, because one of the things that drew me to this fraternity in general was a certain the aesthetic dimensions of it. That it was one of the most, it was like known as kind of like the like preppier frat, like it was like an aesthetic, and it's really hard for me to explain this, but the attraction to it was false on a lot of levels. You know, it was more about embodying, putting on that costume and embodying that to know what it felt like. And I don't know if I'm imparting what I know now onto what I knew then. I could have been in a lot of other frats, but there was something different about SAE in particular. Like it was closer to like the meaning of that Ivy League Dartmouth thing. But it's funny because it was a group of people that were mostly studying economics or math, all competing with each other to see who could get like the totally sweet investment banking internship and job, and then, go on to work in private equity. And there was that was in our pledge class of the 27 guys, 25 of them were economics or math majors.
Mm-hmm.
There was one history major, and then I was an English creative writing major. So even before I joined the frat, some of the things that I was reading, some of the ideas that I was exposed to the day, or I had voluntarily exposed myself to, some of the types of experiences that I had voluntarily exposed myself to, were not similar to the experiences or readings that those other people had. You know, they wouldn't know, they wouldn't have read post-structuralism, or they wouldn't have checked out Foucault, or, you know, done mushrooms. That's totally outside of that worldview. It doesn't play a role in the stably constructed kind of class identity of a lot of those people.
So you were having a more radical exposure than these peers.
See, I was having a totally contradictory experience that was, on the one hand, utterly strange and radical, and then on the other hand, strapping on the costume with the monogram polo shirt.
Of total conventionality, of like Wall Street convention.
But yet I never participated in a single resume drop. I never went to a group interview for a hedge fund. I never did any of that. And it was kind of a butt of the joke in the fraternity. You know, not that I was like unpopular, you know, in the fraternity. I was popular for a while. I was kind of like a conscientious objector to that, but yet maybe exemplified the aesthetic. See, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's dangerous to talk about yourself like this.
Oh no, but I get totally what you're saying. It's like everyone's a contradiction. I mean, to say that you're not is absurd. So what you're just doing is admitting the fact that, like, hey, there was part of me that wanted to be a part of the group that I was rebelling against at the same time. And I don't think that's necessarily that revolutionary. Yeah. I think a lot of people do that. It's just a question of whether or not you're self-aware enough to see it.
You know, part of me just looked at it like another experience, you know, another, a kind of play between, you know, between like true and false. Like there is something all very false about it. You know, I mean, it's built on falsehood. But I mean, coming from like a very middle class background in like suburban New Jersey, like there were certain things that abstract ideas that were associated with that culture that I saw in a different way than someone who might just expect that they would be a part of that or see that it would be a logical continuation. But also, I mean, like before I, you know, between leaving that kind of middle class suburban identity and you know, for a period of time becoming part of this kind of fraternity, you know, Ivy League identity, there was a period of time where like that's where I started doing a lot of the reading and having the experiences that would help me then later call that into question. But it's weird because then those aren't things that I wrote about in the book. You know, I didn't, and I don't understand, like, I mean, I'm as much at a loss about a lot of this as you or anyone else are. You know,
I think culture is really unforgiving for people who happen to question their actions.
Well, culture is not your friend.
No. And I mean, and look at like politically, if someone makes a decision and then changes their mind, they're called a flip-flopper rather than like, wait, I thought this one way. And then with aggregate information, I now think another. I mean, that's part of being a evolved, thoughtful person. You don't have to stick with your convictions completely. From what I read about your life, it's like you had this year away from Dartmouth to kind of take that moment to really digest what it was you were participating in. And I do think that when you're in a kind of groupthink situation where you don't have access to like outside rational thought, you're going to keep going and perpetuating it because you have to justify what you did the day before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's partially why the hazing, the status quo, seems to become a little bit worse every year, because it has to be justified, it has to be externalized and reflected elsewhere, so that the people who agreed to be part of it, or ambiguously agreed to be part of it, don't have to actually get into the heart of the matter in themselves, and that if they can reflect onto someone else, if they can just haze the younger people and make it a little bit harder, maybe they can make themselves feel better about, maybe then they don't have to remember swimming in the kiddie pool or all the times that they had to show up somewhere in a suit and tie only to be told to take all their clothes off and, you know, do these kind of humiliating things. I also don't understand why more psychologists haven't spent time really studying how this type of culture works in general. I mean, I think that there's so many parallels. You know, Stockholm Syndrome with the Stanford Prison Experiment, the Milgram Experiment.
Oh, the Milgram Experiment.
Yeah, but I mean, I think in particularly...
I thought about that a lot when reading your stuff.
It's just such a literal parallel to the Stanford Prison Experiment where, you know, two groups of people, you know, some of the people are prisoners and some of the people are prison guards. And if you see the footage of it and you read about it, it's like... They internalized those social roles to the point where then the prisoners accepted that they were it became too real, you know, and the prison guards became literally brutal, and all it took was just creating this fantasy fantasy experiment that it was happening, and that is like almost exactly what being in a fraternity was like. It's just a bunch of people, and they're playing these social roles that they didn't create, you know, the social roles that they were kind of drafted into or that had been passed down over time. There's nothing real about any of it. But yet it becomes so real to the point that even reasonable people are willing to defend it just for the sake that it already exists.
I think it's definitely indicative of the influence of the system on our psychology. And I think that's why we're in a place in our history where we have all this access to information. We have more knowledge than ever before about all the atrocities that happen in the world and in our own country. Yet we can't seem to actually change the systemic root causes of why we're acting this way, whether it's towards the environment or towards each other. And I mean, we're in this like potential paradigm shift where either we're going to be able to figure out how to relate differently or not, and we're gonna eventually self-destruct and we'll see what happens. But I mean, in terms of you and your story, once you kind of started speaking out against the fraternity culture, I mean, from what I've read and looked at, people were really pissed. Did you anticipate that, or how did that make you feel?
You know, I guess I'm an optimistic person, and like I'm not really a mean person, so it's hard to integrate how mean people really are. People are like really mean.
They're really mean.
They're like cruel, and they're just ignorant, and it's like there's a willful ignorance too. You know, it's funny, like when I wrote the op-ed that became the Rolling Stone story, that became the book, that became whatever it is now, I mean, it's something that's beyond me now. I have no control over it. Like, you know, I just wrote, it was like 750 words in the fucking school newspaper. Like, this is not, you know, this is not like some, this is not like Daniel Ellsberg or something. This was just one person talking about one set of experiences and talking about one set of opinions at a certain time. You know, but people's reaction gave away so much more about the story than anything that I could have said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even now that people persist in this ridiculous conspiracy theory that it's a complete fiction, you know, and even in the Wall Street Journal, there was the op-ed, this ad hominem op-ed, quote-unquote, book review by a Dartmouth alum who had been in a fraternity that was known for doing things far worse than what happened in our fraternity. And I would love to hear this author's experiences. I doubt he would ever talk about it, least of all to me. But, you know, there's this persistent conspiracy theory that has to become so grandiose to include so many other people that then, you know, everyone in the media is involved in it, or that, you know, that Rolling Stone, you know, was involved in perpetuating this conspiracy fiction, and that then the publishers are, and that everyone is involved. I mean, it's insane, and it goes to show how far overboard people are willing to go to defend something that is so clearly wrong. You know, and that I think is just a reflection of their inability to come to terms with it, or just their inner knowledge that it is wrong and that there's actually nothing that they can say except, yeah, you're right. But you know, it's hard for some of them, especially from people from like a more kind of conservative worldview to because in the book I talk very candidly about, you know, personal failures, whatever, you know. And for someone who is such a flawed person, like we all are, you know, to be the one telling you that it's wrong, I feel like it must make it so much harder for them, for people who hide their flaws, to accept that it's wrong.
I mean, One thing that I noticed that's different about you than your other frat brothers, I mean, you explain it in the statistics of all the people that were pledging, is that you were the only student that, rather than studying business and finance and math, were interested in art. You know, you're a musician and you're a writer. Yeah. And when you have an artistic mind and you've cultivated a certain sense of creativity, your life is your art. And to not talk and to not write about your life, which is ultimately your art, is nonsensical, because that's your expression. That's your tool. So, I mean, like, for what it's worth, like, no one's safe with a writer. I don't know. Nobody should trust me ever. Nothing they say to me is sacred.
That's the whole point. Well, maybe I should be careful with what I'm saying here.
But I mean, like, because we are looking at human nature and we're looking at context and we're trying to figure out, like, what are the pieces to put together to make meaning of it all.
Well, and the people who do that, you know, in the culture that we live in now, you know, are then people who are really attacked and made to suffer, you know, in different ways, because getting real, you know, talking about the reality of things is really not permissible.
Right.
You know, it's not, we can't, I mean, whether it's, you know, the U.S. government, you know, being involved in all sorts of violent atrocities, or whether it's, I mean, there are lots of things, you know, that, people are not allowed to tell the truth about.
Right.
Is the risk of getting too far out into the fringe here.
Right. No, but it's incredibly true. I mean, like, why do people lie about affairs? You lie because you can't handle the truth of what happened and you don't want the consequence of the truth. So people hide the truth to not deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
And I think the anger about you revealing the truth is that ultimately when you're looking at it, it doesn't just look ugly. It looks like disgusting, you know.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, like, if you knew you had to swim in a kiddie pool full of semen,
well,
you wouldn't have done it.
Just to be clear, it wasn't full.
I know, but
that
my
would be
image.
That would be a high volume of semen.
Semen.
That would
and,
take a long time to
and vomit and
yeah.
pee and.
You know, and I in the book I'm very careful with going to the nuances that, you know, I'm only speaking to directly what I knew, but yet, you know, people in the media still, as soon as you mention poop and semen, you know, that's it. Like, that's what they're going to talk about.
Because it's so crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think the reason why it's such a potent image is because it's so disgusting and it's so visual. Like, everyone can be like, wow, I really don't want to do that. And why were people participating in that? But I do think that ultimately, the issue is that, you know, you have people doing things they don't want to do to be a part of something. And that goes back to what you said beforehand about community and how ultimately we will do anything to feel connected.
But the weird thing, though, is that on face value, these are things that people don't want to do. But yet there are things that many of us, and I would be lying if I said that I was included, got this kind of sick enjoyment out of doing these things. And I'll tell you a story. When my book was being vetted by a legal team, it was being reviewed, it was being fact-checked, it was being, like, we went literally line by line through the book, spent months. That was really important to do. We had some people come to the publisher and read passages. There was one former fraternity brother who, you know, had direct knowledge of, you know, a vast amount, you know, of these events, was present for majority of the book, you know, came in and he read a couple hundred pages. And at the whole time, I mean, he's just like, I'm sitting there across the table and it's like, he's having so much fun. He's like laughing. It's hysterical. And then I was kind of feeling a little bit weird about that. I'm like, dude, you know, I'm happy that you came here, you know, but this isn't like a funny, carefree book. You know, this is kind of weird, don't you think? And then, you know, afterwards, you know, after he was done reading, we went our separate ways. And then we were going to meet up for dinner later. And when I met with him for dinner, he was so sad. He was just so depressed. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm like, dude, I understand. You know, it's really sad that all these things happened. But that's not why he was sad. He was sad because he said our lives would never be this good again.
Wow.
And he said that when he got in the cab and left the office after fact-checking everything, he said that he was just overcome with a deep sense of depression, that it was over and that life wouldn't go on forever. And I found that to be such a startling relief for me. You know, and this is still a person that I, you know, I'm very good friends with, and, you know, we'll never really agree about what moral or ethical judgments we derive from the events that took place. But there was nothing ironic about him saying that our lives would never be this good again. He wasn't joking. It was literal.
Right.
And there was something that disturbed me about that. But there was also something that was kind of heartwarming about it, because it was just so closed off.
Right.
That, like, maybe heartwarming is not the right phrase, but there was something, I almost felt a sense of, like, tenderness for this person that they would possibly have that point of view.
Well, I think it's a little bit about repression, too. I mean, we live in a really sexually repressed culture, as well as socially
repressed in every way possible.
Right, and then here was this time of total expression. I mean, if you look at something like Burning Man, what is that but an opportunity for people to express all their deviance, express their radicalism, express their sexuality? And people really need that outlet. I mean, for most of human history, you would have, like, ceremonies and nights where you could just have an orgy and everything was fine for one night, just so you would have an outlet to release. And we don't have that anymore. Yeah. There's so much convention and there's so much that we have to hold in. When you think about the convention of marriage and of institution and religion and jobs and what have you. So I can see how someone would look back on that with, like, a nostalgia that was, like, really potent.
You know, and in some ways, like, some days I'm nostalgic about it too. You know, because then the contrast between that and you know, the life that I lead now, which is rather conventional in a lot of ways.
Like, you don't puke on people every day.
No, I mean, no, I don't want to either, you know. But I think that, yeah, what you're saying goes back to that.
It's like the bacchanalia.
That obviously, like, that has a role in our society, and it should, but it's so different, too, when we're talking about that being a gender-segregated system that is clearly, like, out of step with the values of the culture. But then I'm kind of hesitant to... I have that argument, and I put forward that argument, but I'm also kind of hesitant about that, too, because I don't want to live in a sanitized world, you know, where there's no transgression or where everything is politically correct.
Right.
But yet, like, there has to be... You know, I don't know. You know, I don't see that a lot of people from other countries are so fascinated, repulsed, confused by this type of culture in America, because, like, they deal with that human need in other ways. But we deal with it in a really kind of puritanical, like, dialectical, violent way.
Right. It's so extreme. Because, like, in Europe, for instance, you watch a commercial and there's, like, tits selling, like, actual tits with a nipple selling toothpaste. And here, you just don't have that. So we have less outlets, and therefore it feeds extremity.
Yeah.
We're not a balanced culture. And without balance, you're going to kind of be very bipolar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this whole, you know, experience and system that I kind of, like, call into question in the book... Or really leave it up to the reader to call into question. I mean, I'm just telling you the facts as they happened, and occasionally some things that I was feeling at the time, but trying to keep it very almost blank so that, you know, the reader can fill in their own conclusions, you know. It's not like a political book in nature.
Right.
People will have political conclusions about it, but, you know, I think that this set of experience is like experiences is a reflection of that lack of balance. You know, I think it's so interesting, too. There's one part in the book, I don't know how much of it you read, but there's one part in the book where, now, cocaine was very important in the frat to a certain group of people who had the most kind of, on the hierarchy, you know, they had a lot of the social capital, with soshcap, the phrase that people use at Dartmouth, like, unironic thing, you know, somebody would have more soshcap than another. And, you know, there was this cocaine soshcap connection, and there was one of the pledge trainers, you know, who had the most cachet in the organization, who represented the values and the, you know, the ironic values too of what the fraternity was about. You know, there's one part where he refers to, you know, smoking weed as a blue collar drug, and that cocaine is a white collar drug, and that you need to learn the difference between the two. And it was so funny because people didn't really smoke pot in the house. I remember, like, there would be times where, like, there would be, like, let me see, like, one, like, 7 or 8 bedrooms in the house. And there was, like, maybe one that was, like, it was okay to smoke pot in there. And if you were smoking pot in another place, that was like a mortal sin. I remember at one time, I talk about a lot the Wednesday night meetings in the fraternity. That's where most of this vomiting takes place, the kind of misogynistic stories. And, you know, people would sometimes smoke cigarettes, but it would mostly be about chugging beer. And one time we brought a couple of joints and we're just kind of standing in the corner smoking joints during meetings. And people got really up in arms about it. I mean, these were like very straight-laced people who yet, in this puritanical, straight-laced way, would say, no, you can't even smoke pot within 15 feet of me. You have to put the joint out because I have a hair test for my new corporate job next month, which doesn't really make any sense. But yet, it's totally okay for them to like be vomiting on each other or vomiting on themselves or vomiting on each other's penises, you know? But yet, like, having like a natural plant, you know, being inhaled in the room, like, that was taboo.
It's interesting when you think about class too, and like cocaine being the high class drug to do and weed being the lower class drug to do. And obviously class plays a huge part in this whole fraternity culture, but also like, what does weed do besides make you hungry? Is it makes you reflective.
Yeah. It decontextualizes the environment that you start to actually see things. And then you realize that you never actually saw them before.
Right.
You know,
like you can be really high on cocaine and be like, this is amazing. This puking. And
yeah,
shit.
But
if you smoke pot, you're going to be like, what's happening?
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm scared.
Yeah. So I think that, and that's also a reflection of society in general, where like the edifice that we have built, you know, runs on stimulation and narrow focus, and any kind of substance that would expand your focus or make you critical or questioning, we can't let that happen, because
right.
then if somebody actually comes into contact with some kind of deeper spiritual godlike experience, or if they just get high and they're watching CNN and they're like, wait a minute, like this is all bullshit, like this is like a movie and they're making it up, and this, you know, or you know, like the I mean, not to get too far afield, but I think that the fraternity reaction to that kind of became like a total microcosm.
Yeah.
You know, of that social issue in general.
So one question I have to end is, what do you think the solution is? Like, what, you wrote this book, and that's part of the solution, I would think, is spreading information and getting people talking about this. Because, like you said, if this was happening in the 20s with your grandpa, people weren't talking about it. Now people are discussing it. And I'm sure that even with all the negative attention you may have gotten from people that were also in fraternities, you had to have gotten a lot of positive support, especially from women who've experienced assault, or liberal people who are like, wow, I am not a part of this system and never agreed with it and have always found it to be problematic. So, you know, like, what are you thinking are like the next steps, not only for yourself, but for culture to kind of start addressing these issues?
You know, I've gotten a lot of support, but a fraction of, the vitriol, you know, has been support. Wait, hold on one second. Kind of like, so there's really not as much, I haven't gotten as much direct support as you might think, as like a reasonable person might think.
Right.
Which is kind of weird, but then again, like I wasn't doing it to please other people, clearly. You know, this is not a pleasing thing to do. But I think it was, in many ways, the right thing to do. In terms of what's next, people have to ask themselves, and colleges have to ask themselves, like, what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of world do we live in now? And what's the gap between the two? And how do we cross that gap? On a practical level, I mean, I think schools need to accept that, like, you know, the Greek system culture that is, you know, worse on a lot of campuses, you know, in the South, in the Midwest. It's very different than what it is at a seemingly liberal, you know, New England school. These schools need to take a long look in the mirror and be like, is this who we are, or is this a part of our educational mission, or is this something that actually threatens to totally shipwreck what we hold dear? But then I would wonder, a lot of these people, in higher education and people who profit off of higher education on various levels in various ways, I wonder if, again, it's another microcosm about our society where if the people are distracted and harming each other and intoxicated, you know, then they're not They're not thinking like, well, wait a minute. Like, they're not thinking about the bigger issues. So then I wonder, like, do a lot of schools, do they actually want to do anything? Like, maybe not, you
right.
know?
Right. And especially what you were saying beforehand about the brand of college. It doesn't serve the brand when you're trying to get, especially for the college loan groups,
yeah.
which is a huge industry.
Yeah. I mean, the college loan bubble in America now is larger than consumer credit card debt. You know, it's a... There's more than $1 trillion of student loans.
And young people in debt are much likely to fall into the system
yeah.
and not challenge it because they're in debt and they're just trying to figure out how to climb their way
out
of it.
And that's another reason, another factor driving why people have joined fraternities more, because there's this belief that anything that can give you a slight advantage of upward mobility when you're taking out what's equivalent to a mortgage on a house to go to school, people think, okay, well, I'll suffer through the hazing if maybe I can get a job. And there are a lot of people who get jobs from that. But in terms of things that guarantee, you know, discipline and guarantee that people don't deviate from the expected path of, you know, social stability as envisioned by the people on the top of the pyramid, I mean, this might be a good thing to them.
Oh, you know? Yeah, definitely.
People who kill a lot of brain cells, drinking a lot, and they owe a lot of money, like, that's a good demographic for a lot of
They're
people.
They're perfect slaves to the system.
Yeah. So, you know...
But, I mean, I have to say that I think the one step that you've made, which is pivotal, is by highlighting this and putting a spotlight to what's going on. The answer is really in the next generation who start to think, like, this isn't that cool. I was just told of this story where this guy, he's a teacher at a school, and he went in to the student's room, and there was, like, a picture of a naked lady. Mm-hmm. And rather, you know, like, she had, like, nothing on, and she was super skinny. And so he said, wow, do you know the history of, like, why skinny models are really popular? And the student was like, no, I don't. And he said, well, with every wave of feminism, when women wanted to own land, when women wanted to vote, and when women wanted equal rights... advertisers made women skinnier so they would be less physically powerful. And like that kid just listened to him, and then he just took the poster off the wall himself.
Kind of like, mind-blowing for like a 16-year-old kid to get
that and be
check.
Like, so advertisers want weak women. And he was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I just think like what you're doing is you're like, hey, this is what's really happening. And if the next generation can kind of be like, wait, what? Like basically I'm being primed to be a slave to the system of a government that's going to fight endless wars.
Yeah.
Maybe not. What you did is really admirable. And
well, thank you.
I thank you for doing it. And I was really inspired by it. And I hope that you get the recognition you deserve well, by putting yourself on blast.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, it's been a weird trip to have. Like, I didn't picture any of this happening like this. Like, it's just weird that we're here and we're talking about this. And like, I've walked by here so many times before any of this ever happened.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it just comes down to a question of what kind of world do we want to live in? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the younger generation will have the strength to do that. I mean, when college is so sold to people,
right?
You know, and if you have the belief, like a lot of people do, that advertising is a form of terrorism, you know, to the individual, then. When you connect that with the extent to which college is advertised and these experiences are advertised, then maybe it's helpful to just automatically play the mind game with yourself where you think the opposite of everything that you're told. And it would be great if a lot of
George Costanza of life, just do the opposite of everything.
Yeah, I think if a lot of 15 and 16 year old kids had the strength to do that, that would be great. But you know, the media. I mean, it's such a double-edged sword too in the media culture that we live in now, where there's so much access to information that the meaningful true information is often drowned out, and that on the one hand, like you know we hold in our pockets you know at any given time like most of the knowledge of humanity,
right?
And we can find it pretty easily, but yet. What do we usually, I mean, are we usually doing that or no?
Uploading Instagram pictures.
Yeah. We're taking selfies,
yeah.
You know, and that's like a, you know, that's government approved like behavior. but so I think one thing that I wanted to accomplish with this book was just to show that, offer the contrasting point of view of that type of experience that we don't really get in the media. You don't get the darkness. You don't get the sadness. You don't get the self-doubt and the anxiety and the moments where you feel like, wow, have I ruined my life? Or like, maybe I'm going to die. You know, you don't get that a lot. You know, you get the happy-go-lucky Animal House, you know, girls at the party. You know, Revenge of the Nerds was on TV the other day, and there's a scene in Revenge of the Nerds of, like, a frat party. And I'm like, you know, this is such a, it's not a conscious thing, but it's such a comprehensive portrait that's constantly being sold and, you know, in all these different ways. You know, this is obviously, this issue is such a minor part of the broader issues that the younger generation, you know, and like my generation, you know, are, you know, face and will face in the future. But, you know, it's just, it felt like for me a meaningful starting point because, you know, it was just, I wrote about what I knew at the time. And that was what I happened to know. Whereas, you know, I can put that experience forward, but in a book, a lot of the kind of superstructure of it is held back because, you know, the intellectualizations of it is not, they're not really present there because those don't really communicate with people, with the average person,
right?
You know, in the way that just talking about a human experience would.
Right.
You know, but I mean, I think that it's a starting point to unravel the kind of corruption and kind of just fucked up nature of education in America in general. And especially as we compare it to other countries, and especially as we talk about, you know, access to information in general, where then maybe in a decade, this whole idea of education and this financial edifice of it will not seem important anymore because people, I mean, like, since I left Dartmouth, I mean, I didn't graduate, I feel as if I've learned more just on my own.
Right.
And I think that there's nothing unique about that. Anybody can do that. Anybody can get a library card or start to, like, you read something and you know, and one thing always leads you to the next thing. And then, you know, you can arm yourself with, you know, dangerous ideas that are helpful and important for people to have.
I think that should be the title of your new book, Dangerous Ideas That Are Helpful But Important For You To Have.
Yeah.
So tell me, what's the website of your book and where can people buy it?
You can just go to andrewlose.com. And there are links to the different online retailers.
And you can get it on Amazon.
You get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, go to Goodreads, IndieBound. It should be in every major bookstore that sells new books. Oh, no. The book is called Confessions of an Ivy League Frat Boy.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.